Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banatini, and here I discuss brain imaging findings and methods with scientists from around the world. Today, my guest is Rotem Botvinnik-Netzer, a postdoc at Dartmouth University, working with Dr. Tor Wagger in his Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience lab. In 2020, Dr. Botvinnik-Netzer was first author of an influential paper published in Nature titled Variability in the Analysis of a Single Neuroimaging Dataset by Many Teams, where the results were compared from 70 independent teams analyzing a single dataset having 9 hypotheses. This paper made it clear that there are many points of variability in data analysis pipelines and provided further incentives for sharing data and code to grow consensus and replicability. While the popular press suggested that this paper was yet another hit to fMRI, we discuss how even papers that critique the results of this seminal paper ultimately converge on agreement with the overall message of systematic transparency. Dr. Botvinnik-Netzer also has a strong interest in how our brains influence our perception of pain, having just published a recent paper showing evidence that regions associated with painful stimuli remain active even when the subjects experience less pain while having the belief that a placebo is effective. In this conversation, we delve into all these topics and more, but spend the bulk of the discussion on the interplay between choices in analysis, such as determining the statistical threshold, and variability in results. We also discuss incentives for users to share data and code, and possible ways to create a more solid scaffolding for best practices. Rotem was such a pleasure to have on as a guest. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Today, I'm with Rotem Botvinnik-Netzer, and she's been doing some really outstanding work during her postdoc career so far. She first caught my attention when her paper came out that was published in Nature in 2020. Basically, it's the title of it is Variability in the Analysis of Single Neuroimaging Dataset by Many Teams, and it got a lot of attention, and it really helped, I think, helped push the field forward and make people a little bit more aware of the variability, even with the same data set. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, great. And so we'll get into talking about the paper and a few other, a little bit of other, the work that you've done, and even in general, talking about, you know, your perspective starting out as a young scientist and, you know, being ready to move on to the next stage of more independence, and also your work with interacting with OHBM. But just to begin, I always like to start out, because I think everyone is always intrigued with people's backgrounds a little bit. Just in general, how did you, or was there any sort of specific occurrence, or was it a general, you know, gradual movement towards neuroscience? How did you first become interested in neuroscience, and then specifically neuroimaging?
Yeah, so I was I think from a young age, I was very interested about biology and the brain and behavior. And then just before college, I read a book, Physiology of Behavior by Neil Carson, which is a book used in many classes in neuroscience. And I just read it and it was so, so fascinating. I couldn't stop reading. And I think that's where I realized this is what I want to study. And I come from Israel, where you choose your major when you start college, not afterwards. So I just chose it, biology and psychology with emphasis on neuroscience. And ever since, I just, you know, everything is so fascinating in the brain and the behavior. So I was cut off and I just couldn't do anything else, I guess, from that point on.
Well, that's cool. And so right. So you start, I mean, in the States that happens too, but people, you know, are not, I mean, as far as picking their major, but then they switch a lot, but, or else they might, you know, kind of try to hedge their bets and then figure out, you know, what to do at some point midway through. But, and it's great, actually, the whole process of searching and reading these books and realizing, oh, something, you know, feeling when something resonates well with you. And So that's so you actually grew up in Tel Aviv, or did you
near Tel Aviv?
Okay, all right, great. So you know you did your graduate work with Tom Schoenberg and Yaniv Asaf. I recognize Yaniv Asaf's name. He's has done a lot of amazing work. What was that like, as far as that's concerned? Did you feel like this is what you wanted to do, and it seems like you shifted a little bit when you went into Torweger's lab?
Yeah. So I was always fascinated by placebo effect, like ever since reading this book, and in general, like all the mind-body interactions. So I knew I wanted to study placebo, but there was no real lab in Israel studying placebo in humans at the time, focusing on that. And there were so many other topics that were interesting to me. So I just chose something else. I was, during my undergrad, I worked with Yaniv Asaf and Ido Tavor and other people in his lab. And I did some plasticity, brain plasticity studies with diffusion imaging mainly.
Yep.
And I wanted to continue doing that in my PhD, but then I thought about the placebo and many behaviors I want to study. And Tom Schoenberg just came back from doing a postdoc with Ross Baldrock. Uh-huh. And started his lab there. And Yaniv suggested that, you know, he's a great fit to me too. So I ended up doing a PhD with both, but actually I was the first PhD student of Tom. So I kind of focused on, you know, with his lab, you know, building with him. So I ended up doing decision-making studies with fMRI and diffusion imaging and looking at the brain plasticity and neural changes when behavior change. And it was really great. Like, I had so much fun, and I knew I just want to continue the research and hopefully have my own lab, which I'm lucky to be opening next year. So yeah, it was really great. Yeah, I mean, I have mainly positive things to say about all this time. They were wonderful mentors. So
that's great to have good mentors who sort of open up things for you, and you know, sort of show you, you know, various directions and opportunities. And so then you moved to Dartmouth. I mean, that must have been, you know, even in the States, going to Dartmouth from people I've talked to is a cultural, you know, it's very different in the sense that it's a small town. It's a small college town in the middle of the woods and, you know, mountains. And what was that like, actually?
Yeah, so Tor was like a perfect fit for me because, you know, he's studying placebo, which is exactly what I wanted to study. And he's one of the board experts on that. And he's like using rigor grade methods that fit my interest, and he's such a kind person, great scientist. So I heard so many great things, and I knew this was probably the lab for me. I started talking to him actually before I came to Dartmouth. He was in Boulder, Colorado at the time. Yeah. And so I have to say, I did not choose the place, I chose the lab, but I'm probably a lucky human being because Dartmouth actually fits. I have a family and with kids, and this is a wonderful place for kids, and we love nature. So for me, this is much better than a big city, and I'm thrilled we were here. I mean, now it's been 4.5 years. I'm going to finish 5 years before going back to Israel. And, you know, I'm looking from my window now. There's a forest out there. I saw bears a few times. Like, it's really great for us. So we love it here. But it's true. It's very different. Dartmouth is a smaller place, but there are amazing people in the department. You can learn a lot of things and many experts on different topics. So I don't know. For me, it was perfect, I guess.
Yeah. That's
also in the pandemic, by the way. That was a good place to be in.
Yeah. I mean, you're pretty isolated anyway. And so it's just sort of, I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting. I remember I visited Dartmouth in right around 2000, the first time I visited Dartmouth for a workshop. And they were the first campus to actually have, you know, wireless internet on campus, like outside and everything in the courtyard. And I thought, this is just amazing. I can go outside with my computer and log on. And so that was, ahead of its time in that regard. I love the atmosphere of Dartmouth. I think it's just perfect for, you know, getting focused. If you really just want to focus on the work and involve yourself with the great people there.
Yeah.
And Tor is amazing. And also I think as far as the group itself, and Dartmouth especially is strong in this and in other ways, is that you have a good solid neuroimaging core of people, and also, especially with Tor, is that he's a neuroscientist who cares about like a neuroscience effect, but he also cares about methods development.
Yes.
And that's really valuable. And, you know, it seems like you've been benefiting also from both.
As far for as sure. Yeah, he's an amazing scientist, and I'm learning a lot. And we have a large, very diverse group, so you can, you know, interact with people who know different things and have different ideas. And Tor is like a million ideas per second, so that's really amazing to be here.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And yeah, already he's sort of like director. He's moving, he's building his lab even more, and he's director of like the neuroimaging or the whole group there now. And that's just great. So getting into, start with the paper, but just before we get into the paper. So, you know, it seems like a little bit of a shift in focus that you got into focusing on reproducibility or replicability. In this particular case, it's reproducibility, but how did you, like, what was your thought process in terms of thinking up this study or even, you know, getting into this sort of area, since it's like, now you're into sort of like hardcore, you know, processing and dealing with things like that.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I think a few things that happened there. I always focus my research on the brain or behavior and asking questions about decision-making in the past and now placebo and beliefs and expectations. But I think at the end of my undergrad, I started to realize, you know, that analysis and science in general is so complicated and humans are performing it. So we have biases and, you know, so many things can go wrong or can depend on, you know, have different dependencies. So I started to think a lot about that and while I was reading papers. And I think this combining with Tom, who came from Russ's lab and was very dedicated to open science and reproducibility, I think it, like, you know, magnified it, my desire to, you know, focus on that and the knowledge I had. And also papers were coming up about replication process in projecting psychology and p-hacking and all of this kind of stuff. So I read a lot and I got very, very interested. And I just thought, you know, there's a lot of things I want to do better in order to correctly answer or better answer the questions I'm interested in. So this got me to focus on that. And I have, like, I should not get any credit for the idea for the Nature paper because I was not part of it from, you know, at the beginning. It actually started from a group of economists who were part of the education project in psychology. And then they came to Russ and suggested to do a project together about that. And he reached out to Tom and then he started. I joined after the data set was actually collected and I called all the you know, analysis part and all the teams and everything there. So yeah, they had a wonderful idea. I think it was very important. And the moment I got the opportunity to join, I, you know, kind of jumped on it. And it was just, again, I'm a lucky person, like I said. So, you know, being interested in this stuff and this opportunity came and it was just a perfect fit. It was actually not part of my PhD, which was kind of interesting. Yeah. It's not part of my thesis, but I did it at the end of my PhD.
Okay. So, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, it must have been, I mean, it's a huge amount of, I mean, obviously, recruiting all the groups to do this and sort of keeping track of everything. And yeah, it seems like it's a tour de force as far as everything that looked like it, you know, that went into it as far as that's concerned. And actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that the other groups that were involved, because there was one aspect of the paper, we could talk a little bit about it. It was kind of threw me a little bit when I started reading it, the whole concept of prediction markets. And we could get into that as to how that's a useful sort of construct in terms of getting a sense of, you know, how people believe the data is going to be correct or not. But we'll probably get into that in a second. So you had 9 hypotheses, you had 70 independent teams doing it, and it's called the NARPS data set, the Neuroimaging Analysis Replication and Prediction Study. You know, just to, rather than me trying to summarize precisely everything, how would you summarize what your, you know, main thrust of the paper, what the findings were as far as that's concerned?
So we basically collected a new data set of 108 people performing a risky decision-making test, and then we distributed to 70 analysis teams. So each team is independent. It consists of 1 to 3 members. You know, it could be a PI with a PhD student or like something like that. And each team was just asked to take the data along with 9 predefined hypotheses. So each hypothesis is about a specific brain region and whether it goes up or down with a specific aspect of the test. And then to analyze the data as they would for a paper in their lab, we did not want to, you know, impose any restrictions besides computing a whole brain analysis and not just an ROI one. And then report back to us And we asked them to report three different things. One, just a binary decision for each hypothesis, whether or not it was supported by the data. Then a thresholded statistical map for each hypothesis, and an unthresholded statistical map for each hypothesis. And of course, all the metrics they used. We followed Kubida's guidelines for that. And then what we did with that, we took it and we wanted to see whether results were variable and what the sources of variability could be and what we could learn from that. And what we found in general, I will start with the binary decisions. So in general, we found substantial variability there. I have to say that for some hypotheses, there was agreement. Three of them were about the amygdala, and almost all teams said they were not significant. I think besides three or four teams for each one of them. But then for the other, and for one hypothesis, also like 86 or 87% said it is significant. But for the other five hypotheses, there was variability, where between like 20 to 30% of teams reported a different result than the rest, which I think was important because, you know, it's the same data, the same hypothesis. They don't have any motivation to come to a specific, you know, result. So you would probably expect a larger agreement, hopefully, right? So, yeah, we were surprised by that, but then we wanted to look at the actual maps. And at the thresholded maps level, again, it was quite amazing. Like, you could see very different maps for the same hypothesis and the same data. You know, it could range from no significant voxels to like thousands or hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of significant voxels.
Yeah.
And it got us, you know, to really think about it. Because, like, you look at the map and you can't believe it's from the same data. But then in the unthresholded map level, I have to admit it was better. We tried to focus on that on the paper as well, saying that, you know, the correlations between the different unthresholded maps were pretty high for most teams, not all of them, but for most teams. But the thing was that even for this, you know, cluster of, I think it was 50 teams that had very correlated unthresholded maps, still they reported very different binary decisions. So, you know, if they wrote a paper about that, the papers would have been very different.
Interesting.
And that's what he wanted to know, you know, what happens in the wild, right? Because in the end of the day, you read papers and you want to know if the conclusions and the results you see, what, you know, what led to them, and are they affected by the kind of flexible and, you know, arbitrary decisions that people might have made. You know, sometimes you just do something because you're from a lab and this is how it's done there. Sometimes it's the default in the software you're using. Sometimes you did think about it, but you could come to a different, you know, decision. So I think it just highlighted that we need to be mindful of that and think about how, you know, the specific one analysis of one data set, what does it mean? What do we need to know to do to know if, you know, if it's robust, and what could have been if something else was used in the pipeline, right?
Yeah. It seems that, I mean, in the paper, you dissect this a little bit in terms of, you know, right, there's many, many stages of analysis, from pre-processing to choosing your regressors to choosing your thresholds to denoising to, and then finally interpreting the results compared to, you know, whatever you think should be there. And it seems that this still a rich area for dissecting, you know, what decision points, you know, make the most difference. Have you looked into that?
Yeah, we did. So first of all, I forgot to say, the one thing that was really amazing, it was like 70 teams and no two teams chose the exact same pipeline. So for each team, there was a different pipeline. You know, the things you mentioned, they could have used different regressor, different exclusions, different parameters in pre-processing, different parametric tests or a non-parametric test. They could define the parcellations differently, right? So there were many different differences there. We tried to look at the variability. We use a regression model to predict whether they reported significant or unsignificant results. And we found that the estimated smoothness from the image was a significant predictor. And also the software they've used, FSL, people have used FSL reported more significant results. And people who used a parametric test reported more significant results. But I have to say, I wouldn't take these results and count on them too much, because 70 teams sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot of power to actually model all the different decisions, because there were so many. So we couldn't put most of them in the model. You know, just an example, where is the VMPFC, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex? Different teams decided, you know, defined it very differently, and there are so many options we couldn't really add it to the model. So there were so many steps that we couldn't even model and test. So I think other studies are needed to really understand it. And great people in the field are now working on that. I could give examples like Camille Moumet and Greg Kier labs are working on that and trying to find the sources. So hopefully we could learn better about, you know, if we want to see how specific decisions affect results, maybe we could focus on specific steps that make the most difference, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, I was reading through and I thought, well, you know, it seems that to me, yeah, one other aspect is you know, the choice of regressor, if it's, you know, what shape is it, what latencies, you know, things like that. And that's obviously something, but there's many other things. And you're right, you know, there's, it's actually interesting. It's sort of a blind spot that everyone has. Everyone tries to do the most reasonable thing and they think, okay, this is it. Everything that is real, I'll catch. And they don't think of, oh, well, if I, you know, and we just don't have time to try, like, you know, if I do this a little differently, how does this vary things? It's probably worth going through the exercise of that in some sense. And this study, I think, started the whole concept of, you know, the multiverse or the of analysis. And I remember at OHBM the following year after this, I remember seeing Tom Nichols give a talk and showing all these, you know, decision trees that sort of branch out and feeling overwhelmed in some sense, thinking, okay, you know, what the heck? What are we going to do here? On one hand, it felt restrictive, and also it felt like overwhelming, like we don't know what the right answer is. And what do you think is the way forward as far as, okay, so, well, before we even go there, I mean, you know, obviously the popular press took this and said, oh, look, there's this study that says, you know, fMRI results, even the same data set gives you very, very, very different results. And, you know, there's other people, I was just mentioning before the podcast, and I'm co-author on this paper with Paul Taylor, who's been talking with you and collaborating, or not really, you know, he basically wrote, well, if you report unthresholded data, it's not quite, things aren't quite as different as, you know, if you have just these, you know, isolated islands of thresholds. And everyone else, you know, everyone tries to pick the right threshold, but everyone also kind of believes that that's somewhat arbitrary still, because we really don't know the nature of the noise perfectly. And there's all kinds of variables. And so, you know, that's a question of like what the best thing to do is. Of course, you have to pick you have to say it's happening somewhere, but then if you lower the threshold too much, things get similar, but, you know, that's not really a conclusion. It's sort of like a guidepost. But what's your take on that and how to go forward?
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, you mentioned so many things. I have so many things to say about it.
Yeah.
I will start by saying that I will say a few things. First of all, I think we need to combine many different practices for that. Like, there's no one solution that will solve everything, because a lot of things are here, right? So first of all, we should share our code, share our data, so other people can, you know, use it to see if what happens if we change something, because you cannot really test yourself all the different options probably. And then this would help. Pre-registration could help if you know what you're going to do. So at least, like, you know, there's, if you're doing one analysis, at least it's decided from the beginning and not based on the results that you see, which would help too. But it will not solve it, right? Because even a pre-registered shared analysis is still a single analysis, and we don't know what would have happened. So the multiverse is kind of a solution for that. We did not invent it. We just brought it to the neuroimaging world in a way. This term was specified years before, and in behavioral studies, people are using it, or specification curves when you show results on different pipelines, but usually for simpler studies. In neuroimaging, the multiverse is just so huge.
Yeah.
So many different decisions. And like what you mentioned with Tom Nichols, yeah, he's still developing methods to do image-based meta-analysis with the same data. If the data is dependent, you can't just use their usual method. So he is doing great work on that. And we use some of it in the paper, in the North paper. So the idea of multiverse is that let's just try, I mean, run many different pipelines and see if they converge to a single conclusion or not. But then there are many challenges, you know, which pipelines do you need to use? How do you test if they converge? How do you visualize it? How do you report it? How do you do it computationally, right? If it's a large data set, it can be hard. So there are many aspects that different people are working on. Some I know of, some I don't know of course. But I think this would help a lot if we start doing that. It doesn't have to be 70 different teams. You know, one team could do the same. Carp in 2012 showed, he published a very important paper where he took a single data set, fMRI data set, and just ran 7,000, almost 7,000 pipelines alone.
Wow.
And he compared the maps and he saw that, you know, some of them were consistent across the pipelines, but some results really depended on the specific pipeline. So we did not invent the wheel. I think we more like tested it in real life, in the wild with real labs, just doing that. Because who knows how many of the 7,000 pipelines make sense to people or people are
using,
right? So the multiverse could help, if we find the right way to choose the pipelines and, you know, test for their convergence. And I think we're going to this direction in a way. I have to admit that for me, for now, I'm very mindful of that. So when I write a paper, I usually try to at least, test what happens with, major differences, like try something with a different test and then report. Of course, that's the thing, right? You need to report it. It doesn't help if you don't report it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to report some differences in analysis and see how if my results are robust to that. I think it's important. But there's still a lot of way to go. And what Paul Taylor and you and other people in this paper suggested is to, highlight the results, the untreated results more, which I completely agree with. I think it's true. And, the variability just grows when you go forward in your pipeline, right? With your threshold, when you look at a specific region, again, where is the VMPFC? Different people might say different, use different masks.
Yes.
Amygdala might be better defined, but still. So I think it would definitely help. I love the visualization that the paper suggested, and I think it would help. We just need to balance between, giving as much information as we can, but also giving something digestible, right? That people could, build upon. There's so many data in the world. We can't just know all of it and, conclusion based of it. So there's a trade-off. And I think if people also share their untrusted maps, which I've always been doing, it helps too, because then people could use them for image-based meta-analysis, which is much better than coordinate-based. You just get more information.
Yeah.
So I think this, the combination of all of this would make it much better. But even the fact that people are more aware of it helps, I think, and reviewers are more aware of it, and you can think about, whether it affects the results or not.
Yeah. It seems like there should be some other way than, what Paul mentioned in his paper is that, if you unthresholded it and it was just sort of a salt and pepper sort of pattern or random, then clearly it doesn't do much value. It's not much value in thresholding, but it seems that there's still underlying, activity that seems to be lurking below the surface. And you think, okay, that if you average more, that would probably reach surpass the threshold. It seems that there should be some sort of method of iterating between thresholds and that sort of getting a better sense of the extent of the data without completely unthresholding. But I don't know. It seems that it's still evolving as far as it's concerned.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah, there's a long way to go before we set up on how to do it correctly.
But
great ideas out there. So.
Yeah. Also, so just briefly in the paper, you have you as I was reading it, I was just thinking, okay, now they're talking about prediction markets. I've never heard that concept before. And I was kind of curious, is that a useful thing to employ in other sorts of studies? Or what was the goal of that approach? And what was it as far as that's concerned?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the economists are actually the people who started this project. Felix Holzmeister, Colin Kammer, Anna Drebber, Jürgen Lieber, Magnus Jensen, and Michael Kirchler. It's a group of economists who were working together. And they did a prediction markets before. For example, when there was the project to replicate 100 studies in psychology, they used it. And the idea was to see whether peers can predict whether a study would replicate or not. And if they can, then maybe we could, we don't need to replicate every study. We could use this knowledge to kind of predict what would be robust or not. That was the main idea. And the performance of the prediction markets was quite impressive in the first project. Here it was a bit, I will give some background. So in prediction market, what happens is that people, like researchers from the field, kind of go into a platform that illustrates a prediction, a stock market, where each stock that you can invest in is kind of a study or a result, whether this study would replicate, for example.
Okay.
And then you get some money to start with, and you put your money, you invest your money, and based on your performance, whether you predicted the results correctly or not, you get paid at the end. So you have incentive to be correct. And as I said, in the previous studies before us, the performance was quite good and people were able to predict the results nicely. I mean, of course, not perfectly, but nicely. Here we could not do it exactly like that because we had, you know, this one study but many teams. So the prediction was about how many teams would report a significant result in each hypothesis. So we had 9 hypotesis. And we had actually 2 different prediction markets. One was for people that were not part of the NARP study, were not part of an analysis team. So they did not know, you know, they did not see the data, they did not know the results, they just knew what we're doing. The other team was groups that were part of the study. They knew, you know, they analyzed the data, they knew their own results. They did not know the results of anyone else. So at the time, the only people in the world who knew the results were me and Tom. And even not the economists who were in charge of the prediction market.
Okay.
So we had 2 different markets. We didn't want people who knew the data to affect people who did not or anything like that. And in both markets, what we found is that people were over-optimistic in thinking that, you know, there were going to be significant results. So even groups that reported a non-significant result thought that most teams would say it's significant. So this was quite amazing. And this study tried to replicate, you know, previous literature. So they probably thought, you know, we would be able to replicate these previous studies. Yeah. Another really interesting thing we found is that we asked people to estimate their expertise in neuroimaging and their expertise in decision sciences. So self-report. And there was absolutely no correlation between how, you know, their rate of expertise and whether they were able to predict the results correctly or not. It didn't matter if they were experts or not, if they were, you know, if they were young, senior or junior, nothing really predicted their performance. So this was interesting too.
That's interesting. That's interesting. And do you think the reason for that is it's just, you know, human nature, you know, an intrinsic bias towards, you know, being optimistic as far as the, you know, seeing some of the literature and then having a sense of, okay, it's probably, things are probably going to be, you know, reproducible or, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it sort of taps into our own hidden biases.
Yeah, I think it's a combination probably of people are optimistic and, you know, I don't know, I think when we read papers, like there's a bias where we think, you know, so this is something we now know is true. So we or think it's true. So we expect it to be true in the future as well. Yeah, definitely human biases.
So, or do you think, or, you know, another way of potentially looking at it is, I mean, if you do lower the threshold, you know, results get a little better and maybe it's people's intrinsic ability to sort of, you know, look beyond in some sense, or, you know, and have a sense of what's below the threshold and say, okay, that's probably going to be real or not. It'd be interesting to do it if you knew what ground truth was in some sense. If it matched, like, if it was more, was it more optimistic than the results with the threshold results? Or, and do you think, like, at what, it would be interesting actually to lower the threshold just artificially, whatever, until it matched their predictions. in the sense that, you know, and maybe that, is that like a crowdsourced way of of choosing thresholds. I don't know if that makes any sense. It just reminds me of other studies where people are, you know, there's sort of a crowdsourcing of predicting, you know, markets and other things, and usually or predict or like guessing someone's weight or something like that. Usually, any one person is wrong, but if you have like you average enough people, it sort of it kind of. It actually usually ends up being true, whatever more accurate. So I wonder if their predictions, it might, I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying this is the case, but this is my own thought of maybe their predictions are accurate and maybe the thresholds were too stringent. I don't know, something like that.
You know, I mean, maybe it's definitely a possibility. I don't know. I wasn't part, you know, I wasn't the investor of the market, but it might be. It's an interesting thought. I think we also need to remember that here they were predicting how many people would report a significant result and not necessarily how many people would reach the right conclusion. Because as you said, we don't know the ground truth. I don't know if that hypothesis is true or not in, you know, real life.
Yeah.
So that's another point to take into consideration. Yeah, I think also maybe people are just also used to seeing significant results because that's, you know, the literature is full of them. So you kind of expect more significant results than not. And maybe you're, you know, the calibration of wait, it's not a publication. That's like what happened in something. Maybe this was hard to, you know, think about. No, everything, because most of them were not significant based on the team's results. I don't know the true answer.
Based
on the team's results. So, yeah, but maybe they were affected by the threshold results. Mainly the teams, you know, the people from the analysis teams.
Yeah. That's interesting. So it was actually a nice added sort of thing that it might be worth doing in other contexts as well. So, okay. So, and was there any, so as far as the feedback you got from the paper itself, so when the paper was eye-opening and it sort of, I love papers like this because it sort of opens up blind spots in some sense and, you know, it gives you a sense of, okay, so we have to, this is a potential issue to deal with. And was there any pushback or, you know, how did the field react in general to the work?
Yeah, so there were many reactions. I think in general it was very positive, and we also made sure to give the positive message because we don't think, you said it in the beginning, you know, the press can take it and say, oh, fMRI is invalid or something like that, but that's not the case, right?
Yeah,
I mean, science is complicated. We just showed something here, and it's been shown before in behavioral data and the many analyst approach, and they showed that also in behavioral data things, you know, are depending on analysis pipeline. So certainly here, when it's high dimensional, there are so many decisions to be made. It's also tested now in other modalities, EEG. It was tested in diffusion to some degree. So it seems the EEG results are not published yet. But it seems that this is true for many different fields, if not all. And I don't think it's unique to MRI, to fMRI. That's what I'm trying to say. And the response were, you know, some of them were a bit pushing back, but not a lot. I have to admit that most responses were positive, and you know, 180 people from the field were part of that. This also affected many people have been part of that, and they knew it before. You know, they were part of writing the paper, so they were not surprised at this point. And also, they felt part of it, and they were motivated, you know, to test this when they joined the project. So I think this is actually a great example of how the field is, you know, open to testing ourselves and finding solutions and improving. I think it's amazing. Like, it's really fun to be part of this field. And I was so lucky, you know, to interact with all these great people, smart people, and learn from them and get feedback. And during the project already, you know, like, think about what it means and what we can do. So
yeah,
I think overall it was positive and got us to, you know, positive directions. There was some, you know,
articles
saying something bad about neuroimaging. It happens once every few years. But
it didn't
really go to this direction in general, which is great.
I totally agree. I think that, and everyone I've talked to has said it's more of an eye-opening thing, and it's generally a positive slant that, and I do think that it sort of catalyzes ways forward. I mean, you've written other papers too. I mean, you just had one that was a little bit of a shift in this. So in Nature Human Behavior, 5 Creative Ways to Promote Reproducible Science. And, you know, it wasn't only talking about, you know, the analysis, it's talking about sort of the whole infrastructure of how to change how people do science. You know, you had things like funded project extensions for people who needed to a little bit more time, or guaranteed funding for registered reports, and the whole concept of registered reports. So I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that. And also, I love the idea of having a, you know, reproducible science knowledge base or a helpline and contact points and things like that. So, yeah, that's actually sort of changing the culture of how things are funded or how people do it.
Completely. So, as I said in the beginning of graduate school, I started, you know, to focusing on this reproducibility and open science while doing, you know, the psychology and neuroscience research. And I think what I did beside the paper we just discussed, the Nature paper, what I focused on the most is trying to help people, you know, adopt these practices for reproducibility and open science. So, for example, me and Tom, my PhD advisor, we developed a course in Tel Aviv for graduate students where we taught them about all the open science practices and reproducibility and why we need them, the motivation and everything. It was really great experience for me. And then there are the papers that you just mentioned, I'll talk about in a second, and a few others that I've done, just trying to, you know, help making it more accessible for people. Because I think as a researcher myself, and not one that, you know, is focused only on the methods or writes the software themselves or something all the time. I mean, I write code, but I don't develop the tools myself that people are using in the world now. So I try to focus on, you know, bridging between this, you know, between all the great tools and platforms that people are making now to do open science and principle and the actual, you know, researcher at the end that needs to use them and needs to do a lot of other stuff and know a lot of other stuff and have different, you know, barriers. So this last paper that you just mentioned, the Nature Human Behavior Commentary, I did with Ronnie Thibault and Josefina Winroba from University of Nottingham, was just trying to think about creative ways on how we can help people use these tools. Of course, we need to change a lot of things systematically, but just try to, in the world we're living now, how can we do it better? And yeah, as you said, we suggested to fund projects better and fund, for example, registered reports in a different way maybe. And one thing that I focused on is the helpline that you mentioned. I think it would help if people will have like a centralized place where they can, you know, get the knowledge they need in order to really start using these practices. And then they can see it's really easier than they might think.
Yeah.
And we tried to do this in a different paper that we published a year or two ago in Neuroimage, where we just gave a review of all the reproducible and open science practices across the research cycle for neuroimaging specifically and for all modalities, not just MRI. With a group of like 20 researchers from around the world. It was, again, wonderful collaboration and an opportunity to work with them. I led it together with Joachim Rieger and Jumar Nissa. And we also did an educational course about them in OHBM last year, where we just try to, you know, give an overview of all the different tools in each stage. You know, when you develop the idea, when you try to start a study, when you do quality control, when you analyze the data, when you test it, when you publish it, throughout the cycle. And then just again, make it easier and develop kind of a resource where people can, you know, have links to different resources, different tools, and they can use that. So we also have an online resource that the paper, you know, based on the paper that people can use. And hopefully we could update it with time because, you know, things keep changing. But I have to admit that this is one thing we're discussing in the Nature Human Behavior paper where, because it's no one's job officially and no one gets paid to do that, it's hard to maintain it, you know, because, like, for example, I'm moving now to start my own lab by focusing on different things. It's hard to find the time to actually keep track and update things all the time.
Yeah.
So what we try to suggest is have some kind of a resource that, you know, like we did in our imaging, try to do, to take a group of experts who can kind of start that and then find a way to make that work in the long term, to fund it. Maybe OHBM could, you know, take responsibility for that in this case, for example, and have someone dedicated to that. Or maybe people can kind of pay it forward. You know, they can contribute, get answers, and then contribute some information. There's the NeuroStar forum, which is a great resource. But again, no one is, it's no one's job.
Yeah.
Which I think is a problem in a way.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, certainly the NIH, they fund, you know, they have educational grants and things like that for courses. But this is even beyond that, right? It's sort of having a resource that's constantly updated, that you can access anytime, that you can get training at or advice from. You can almost imagine, you know, it's sort of a meta sort of science sort of funding that I think is important. I mean, you know, people assume that with fMRI research or in brain imaging research in general, it's sort of organic. It's sort of like the methods sort of evolve and then they sort of settle in and it just works itself out. But they don't realize that, you know, it could probably work itself out a lot faster and better if you had this sort of structure. And yeah, I like that idea. I like that idea. And who knows? I mean, I think that, something started by OHBM, but it's hard to actually, you know, have funding agencies sort of think out of the box in this regard. But who knows? I think people are realizing, I mean, there's certainly a push to data sharing. And so, and this is an example, at the NIH, there's a big push to data sharing and everyone has to have a data sharing plan.
Yeah.
But nobody really knows what the best practices in data sharing are. So they're already going, you know, we have a data sharing team that we've started just for us, but everyone's going to this person, Adam Thomas, who, you know, saying, hey, help us. And you can imagine something like that for that would really be like an institutional knowledge of the field of best practices that evolves over time. I like that idea.
Yeah, we actually suggested both, like to have a centralized field-specific source, like what we started in neuroimaging and other people have done in neuroimaging. I think in neuroimaging we're in a good starting position if someone would be able to maintain it. But also have someone in the department, institution or something that, you know, because data sharing, for example, is very different depending on where you are. In Europe, there are different, you know, laws compared to the US, compared to China, compared to other places. So it helps to have both, kind of like someone close to you can just, you know, go and talk to.
Yeah.
And it knows a lot about these things and about a specific characteristic in where you are, and also like a centralized source that, you know, the experts would keep updating, because new papers, new ideas, new tools are keep coming up. So really, I'm involved, and I have many friends there, and for me, it's hard to keep up with all the tools. So I'm sure that someone who's not motivated or dedicated or, you know, familiar with this world, it's just how do you do it? How do you know what to use, what to do?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, also, right, speaking for myself, at least, I mean, in our group, you know, all we do is try to come up with, you know, better acquisition techniques, you know, higher resolution. You know, we're trying to invent ways of looking at, you know, doing layer fMRI processing. And, you know, there's this Laney platform. And, you know, we haven't completely vetted it against best practices perfectly. And, you know, and even time series analysis of extracting, you know, edge time series or windowed correlations and trying to make significant statements of that. You know, it's hard to know. I mean, luckily we have, you know, people from AFNI or Gang Cheng who are good to consult with as far as what's the proper statistical method. But you're right, the methods are evolving very rapidly. And, you know, even if you're trying to look at, you know, transience in the signal and all kinds of things, you know, people feel like, okay, so, you know, what do you do there? You can't, there's this tension between setting up a registered, you know, report versus exploratory analysis. I mean, and realistically, everyone kind of does both. Even if they do have a solid hypothesis, they still can't help themselves. And you have you mentioned this in one of your papers, how the idea of revising your hypothesis as you go along. I mean, at the extreme, it's just wrong. But somewhere in between, sometimes people do that, and then they say, okay, well, all right, let's do this new study with this different hypothesis, or. You know, obviously, p hacking is a problem too that I think we're made aware of too. So it's all these things are hard because it's messy with regard to human nature and pushing up against the limits of what's possible. And yeah,
yeah. I think what I'm trying to do is, like, I think the theoretical ideals are, like, you know, they keep changing in a way, but some of them are clear at this point. I think, like, what would be best to do or what would be most valid, but. Also, you know, there's the practical day-to-day life, the constraints that we have, you know, limited resources, time, money, knowledge. I mean, you can't read, there's so many papers. You can't know everything, right? There's so many different things. So I think two things we need to take into consideration here is, first of all, that collaboration is really important, because if we, you know, combine our knowledge together, this would be better for sure. And the other thing is that we need to just balance between, right, the ideal and the practical. So one thing Tor and I suggested recently in a book chapter that was just published in the Sage and book of Cognitive and System Neuroscience, kind of suggested a phase model. It's kind of like clinical trials when they go through phases, you know. And the idea is to just lower the barriers to begin to for exploration. Exploration is important. We need both, right? We need both confirmatory studies and exploratory ones. We need to test hypotheses, but we also need to come up with new hypotheses, right, and learn new things. So we try to kind of like suggest something that could balance between them, like starting with studies that are more exploratory and then going up as like more, you know, studies with shared code and data, or reproducible studies, or studies that are tested for robustness to analytical variability. And then in different dimensions, we also, there's like, you know, pre-registration for like confirmatory studies that are shared or not shared and reproducible and robust. So we kind of wanted to put it out there to see if we can kind of formalize the difference. And then each type of study is important and valid. We need all of them, but we can assess the evidence, you know, based on how rigorous it was, how replicable it was, and how much we can trust it. But then we can do all of them, you know. Yeah, we need to be mindful of that.
Yeah. So this, once again, this was your book chapter, Advancing Cognitive Neuroscience, or was that the book, or is that the book chapter within?
No, that's the chapter. Advancing Cognitive Neuroscience is the chapter. The book is the Sage and Book of Cognitive and System Neuroscience.
Okay. And yeah, I like your phase model. In some sense, it's sort of set up kind of like the idea of clinical trial phases or things like that, where, yeah, and you have the diagram laid out there. I like that concept. So the studies would be, you know, like you say, exploratory or confirmatory or shared exploratory, then reproducible exploratory, reproducible confirmatory, and then finally phase four is you know, robust exploratory versus robust confirmatory. So you have two parts of each phase, exploratory and confirmatory, and then the degree of certainty kind of goes forward with the phase. Is this sort of like how you should label your studies if you're doing them, or like in the paper, or how would you, is this like how things are funded, or, you know, what's the plan as far as that's concerned?
That's a good question. Well, I don't have a specified answer for all of that. I think we should think about it more, and I think we need a group of people who, you know, we gave like a preliminary suggestion, but we think that, you know, the actual phases should be defined by, you know, a consensus group or something like that. And yeah, it could be used, you know, each paper can kind of define themselves, and also like when you submit a paper, you could say which type it is, and then we could just, again, it doesn't mean that phase one is not good or something like that. We need all of, and I think most studies currently are actually phase one. Realistic about that. And we need people to explore. We need new methods, new ideas, new samples, you know. But we also need to know, to validate the results. I think we're not doing enough replications in neuroimaging. It's hard, you know, you need money and time. It's just hard to do it. So I think it would give more incentive to do that, to replicate studies, to be more rigor, to share the code, to share the data, and then we could have results that we can kind of trust more in a way, right? Or tested more, and then we could, you know, just proceed like that, and the literature could, you know, correct itself better when we kind of easily know which type of study this is. But it has to be in combination of making it easier for people to do all these things, because we don't have usually millions of dollars per study like in clinical trials, right? Studies are complicated. In clinical trials, usually, you know, one very well-defined test, simple usually, one analysis, and so many people are involved, so much money, documentation. So we can't expect that for every study, you know, in basic science. It won't happen.
Yeah, it's still very dynamic and sort of organic and... but yeah, as I was reading this, and I mentioned this before, as I was reading this this chapter, sort of skimming it and looking at this diagram, I thought, well, you know, some journals, and so this is one thought too, it's like some journals like to have the idea of having like living documents that sort of are updated or whatever. But instead of that, and I mentioned this, is that maybe there could be funding for some group of people who makes a database of the papers and sort of give them a set of metrics, like has this been reproduced, or some value of like how rigorous the analyses are, how well is the data shared, is the code shared, you know, sort of having each paper have some sort of an overall set of quality metrics that how impactful it might be in the field. I mean, and they could just be totally separate, just a database, and could just look up the papers and. I don't know. It would be interesting to see if that would get any traction, because everyone wants to know. I mean, otherwise right now, it's like you read the paper and you're like, oh, that seems pretty good. And, it's like you don't really know. You'd have to do some work in terms of judging it. If you have a team of people focused on just scouring the latest literature and sort of going over, and it might open up, possible opportunities, or it might help change the culture of the field.
Yeah, I think it's a cool idea. I mean, the funding needs to be realized somehow. I think a lot of the problems are the funding, right, and incentives, and how you get credit kind of for what you do. And also, I think another thing that would need to be considered here is that it's kind of subjective sometimes, you know, how rigor or how... There's no one clear answer about, how good the paper is. So we need to be careful of that. Like, I don't want to just judge papers. I do want to get information that's important, and some things are objective, like if the data are shared or not, if this is objective, for example. Was it registered? I mean, it's objective, but also ambiguous to some point, some degree, because there are different pre-registrations, right? There are different degrees of data sharing, so it's not that like black and white. But yeah, I agree, like knowing all this stuff could help, and having some kind of a resource for that. Actually, I was in Nora Academy in summer school in 2018, on our imaging and open science, and we in the hackathon we suggested something that was called an O factor, which is an open science factor for journals. Started to like code something for that. We never really completed it, but like everything in most hackathons. But the idea was that like was try to find not that exactly, but quite close. Like try to give kind of instead of the impact factor, give another metric for journals of how open and reproducible they are, and then to papers and maybe to people or to labs or. It didn't reach that, but the idea was to try to give credit for people for doing this thing, because at the end of the day, you make a lot of effort to share data, do you get something? I mean, you should do it because you're motivated to do it.
Yes.
But also, you know, people should acknowledge that it's hard and that people are working hard to, you know, collect the data and share them and make sure things are reproducible. It takes much more time. But if we want to get to the true, right, to the right answer, we need to do that because, you know, it takes time, but it makes it better, the science. So we need to incentivize that. Like, I think it's more important to incentivize than to, you know, enforce it in some way.
I totally agree. Yeah, and you're right. And you can't just rely on people's wanting to do the right thing. They, you know, everyone has limited time and right. It's all about incentives, either positive or negative. But one of the, you know, a little bit of both would help change the culture, I think.
Yeah,
that's actually a really interesting problem. I think OHBM probably should focus more on things at that level of how to incentivize this more. So, okay. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about with this, but, you know, it's also interesting because in terms of changing the culture, just to finish up this, there's still people who I talk to with from time to time who think, well, you know, the whole natural process of papers being accepted and, you know, either the papers die out or they don't die out, based on, you know, how real the results are, they, you know, people feel like, okay, that's probably, you know, it's been working for the last 100 or so years. You know, why not just continue it? And I think that while that's true, it does work. It's just slow and inefficient. And it seems that now as things are accelerating, it's all the more important to have better structures for that. So
I mean, I agree in general, but I think also I'm not sure it's working well now because I think the amount of papers just so, you know, it's exponentially growing. And, you know, the papers will survive or not might not depend on whether they're true or not, but also whether, like, you know, what lab they came from, who wrote them, how, you know, exposed they are in social media, how much they gain traction. You know, there are some other reasons for paper to persist, although it might be wrong.
Yes.
And again, because in our imaging, replications are rare. I don't think we're really testing. And I know personally of a lot of examples of people who try to do something they were sure would gonna work just because papers published on that. It didn't work. And then you just do something else. You don't really publish, you know, didn't work. So I think that's the issue. Humans are doing science. So we need to keep that in mind. And humans are not objective. And humans have biases. And they affect what we, you know, publish at the end and what we understand from what we read. So I think just trusting on that happening on itself, I would be careful with it.
Yes. No, I agree with you. And you're right. It does break down when the system gets too large. And so, and you just don't want the field to be spinning its wheels. And that's, you know, there's probably a lot of energy just spent that way. And, you know, like you said, there's a lot of, you know, there's so many negative results that are not reported. And nobody, and people try those experiments and then they can't find them. They don't report them again. And so it's like so much things like that. It would be worth writing about all the wasted effort, you know, review article of all the wasted effort.
And money, you know.
And money.
We have limited resources. I think we should use them wisely. And I would like to, you know, invest them on things that are more likely to work or really worked in the past and not, you know, work for one person, but not for 100 that I'm not aware of.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah. It's okay. Well, how about, that, I mean, like I said, there's so much more to talk about, but, I just wanted to try to talk about two other things really quickly. You actually do other work other than caring about meta-analysis and replication. And you have a paper right now, it's in BioArchive. I believe it's on. It's under review. Placebo treatment affects brain systems related to affective and cognitive processes, but not nociceptive pain. And it was really, obviously this is sort of along the theme of, you know, what Tor cares about, but also what you're interested in. So this was eye-opening in some sense. This was one of the first papers I don't follow the literature closely, but it seems that looking at the brain activation associated with placebo effects and showing how there's no change in like your typical pain centers, but there are changes elsewhere. So why don't you talk about a little bit there? It was very cool.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so as I said in the beginning, you know, what I really wanted to study always is placebo. And I'm opening my own lab in the summer, and that's what I'm going to focus on, placebo and expectation and beliefs and how we update them. And so all the reproducibility, open science things are a major part of what I do, but they're not really my focus in a way, right? So What we're trying to do there was to take placebo. So placebo effects are studied in many different labs, and in the last decade or 2 decades, it's gaining a lot of, you know, attention. And we're trying to understand what's the mechanism, you know, why placebos are working so well, and maybe how we can leverage that to improve clinical trials and clinical practice, you know, treatment in general. So what we did in this paper, we used a very large sample size for, you know, for a test like placebo. It was with almost 400 people. I know it doesn't sound a lot compared to biobank or something, but it's, you know, it's a very specific task for one study, which is a lot. Yeah. And we tried with this large sample to test previous results and a question of whether placebo in specific in analgesia, whether it affects the pain nociceptive regions, like the regions of response to the pain in the lower level or the higher level interpretation that we give. This pain at the end, the pain that we report or feel is the combination of the nociception and the, you know, interpretation that we give it, the emotional, social, cognitive aspects. And there were inconsistencies in the past, as many studies have shown effects on lower level things like in the spinal cord and insula and thalamus and lower level regions. But we want to test it with a large sample size and see what happens. And what we found is that actually these lower level brain regions, like the pain metrics, it's called the regions response to pain, were not affected by the placebo. And they were not just not affected. We tested with, because of the large sample size, we used Bayes factors, which allows you to test for evidence in favor of the null effect, not just in favor of the H1 hypothesis. So we found significant null effects, right? The strong support for a null effect, meaning that placebo does not affect these regions or neuromarkers that represent the response to nociception pain, but rather that higher level regions are affected, the prefrontal cortex, striatal regions, and the neuromarker that was developed before. And I think what's unique in this study is, again, we had the large sample size. We also pre-registered specific neuromarkers and regions that we were about to test. So you know, the exploration was constrained, and that we could use the Bayes factors to give. I think it's a good direction in general to try and provide evidence for null versus alternative, just because you know it's not enough to know that something is significant or not. It's also, if it's not significant, it's interesting if it's, you know, if you can learn that it's just, you know, not different or something like that, and not just that it's not significantly different, right?
Yeah, could you explain a little bit more how you do that? Because I think a lot of people still just have in their mind that you can never disprove an hypothesis. So how did you set up the null when you're trying to prove something doesn't change?
So we never prove, right? We cannot prove that. I agree with that. But what we do is we kind of quantify the evidence in favor of the alternative hypothesis compared to the null hypothesis. So you need to define both hypotheses. You have some priors because it's based on statistics, but you can, there are some default reasonable ones that you could use if you don't have a specific you know, direction.
Yeah.
We use neutral ones here. And we also tested, just going back to the analytical variability, I tested it with different priors to make sure my results are robust to that. So this is one thing, how I kind of apply what I learned from NARCH to my own studies. So that's, they're just a way, the Bayes factors just help you get a number that says how much the evidence supports the null compared to the alternative hypothesis. And different numbers provide weak or strong support for one of them. You need large sample size to really get, you know, strong support for now, like to be able to get strong support for the null. But we had it here. So we got very strong support of the null, and we learned a lot from that. I think the field could, placebo could learn a lot from that.
So in terms of interpreting this result, so, I mean, did you actually look also at the, I mean, everyone responds to placebos in different ways. You know, the individual subject variation and or even like the behavioral response as it related to the other areas that might be essential for engaging the placebo sort of effect. I mean, so those areas didn't go down in terms of the nociceptive areas, but you had mentioned there might be other, you know, what do you think is the, you know, what do you think's going on as far as how we do, you know, suppress pain by our belief that something's working, you know, different people have different skills in this. Was there any variation with people's skill or belief?
Yeah, so there's a lot of individual differences for sure. Yes. And people are trying to predict who would respond to placebos. There are many studies on that. We did not focus on that on this specific paper, but we have a lot of data that we're going to. But in general, what we think is going on is that, you know, again, pain, there's like the model of pain that says that like pain is a combination of the biological, psychological, and social aspects. You know, you send something in your receptors, it goes up to your brain. And then it combines with some top-down processes of, you know, the context, what you expect would happen, what you believe about it, who is with you currently, what do you think about the physician who may be treating you, and a lot of other characteristics. And all of this together combines to give how much pain you feel.
Yeah.
And of course, there's another step of how much pain you report. It doesn't have to be the same, right? Maybe you're trying to show how strong you are now and how resistant you are, and you say something else. But what they found here is that it wasn't the decision bias. Like, it wasn't like they felt high pain, but they reported less or something. But the interpretation, the higher level, the top-down processes affected how they, how much pain they actually felt at the end of the day. And then the top-down regions are kind of interacting with the lower, with the bottom-up signal, and together give the final result. So, you know, I don't know exactly the specific mechanism yet, but I think it's definitely something that goes from top down, and it does not change the lower level. It doesn't seem to change the lower level processes. But also we tested, you know, a specific type of placebo in pain, and with thermal pain and mechanical pain specifically. And we use suggestions and conditioning. There are many different types of ways to induce placebo. And it could work differently for different people and for different contexts. So this is much more complicated than that. But I think it's a start, you know, to give us some clue of where to look.
Yeah. It's actually, it reminded me when I was reading this a little bit of a very early study back in the early 2000s, one of the first ones. I don't even know if that was replicated well, but of neurofeedback of, basically, you identify the regions, at least here, the study just identified the main regions that are associated with pain. And they had subject, those areas were fed back to the subject, and they came up with a strategy for reducing the activity in those areas, and it corresponded with them feeling less pain. So while I don't know about, the quality of those results, there seems like there's a link in terms of, once you identify those areas, either you could, you could do neuromodulation, or you could, give feedback, neurofeedback based on those areas to either increase or decrease, and it might have behavioral effects. But it's a really interesting area. I mean, it's wide open in terms of your own ability of your mind to affect your subjective experience. And it seems like, couldn't you also measure subjective experience of pain by things like skin conductance, or it's like, instead of just using the report,
definitely. Yeah, many studies are using skin conductance specifically. We did not analyze it here, but what Tor and us are trying to do is to develop neuromarkers that could, serve as the objective measure. And there's the NPS, neurologic pain signature, which we used in this study too, which was validated in many studies now. And it's like a neuromarker that responds to changes in the nociception. So if you give like lower intensity stimulus, for example, it will respond less. But if you do all this top-down interventions, like cues that make you expect less pain or placebo, it seems that it's not affected by that. So it is more like of a signature that of the nociception part of that. And there's another signature we've used. It's called SIPS, which is the other part, like the higher level. So we're trying to use the brain as this biomarker for pain or for placebo effects. And I think it's a really promising direction because, we should not just rely on self-reports because, as I said before, it can also be affected by decision biases. And also maybe there are some people who can't report because they're like in clinical conditions that are not allowing them to report pain, and we want to know if they're in pain. So it would be very beneficial to be able to know that without talking to them.
Okay. Yeah, no, as you're saying this, I recall now, suddenly this, that Tor had this pretty amazing paper in the New England Journal of Medicine on objective measures of neuro measures of pain.
And, that was the NPS paper.
Yeah.
I think in general, placebos are very promising. I mean, people see them as like, no, we're tricking people or deceiving them. But I think what we learn from placebo is that there are effects there that are just your own body kind of healing yourself, and we could just use it. We don't need to deceive anyone. We could understand them better and use them. We've active treatments and make people better, right? So I'm very excited about that, like about trying to develop ways to do that.
Yeah, that's great. If they just make it into a science of sort of, you know, have a clear mechanism by how that's done. Yeah, that'd be great. So, okay, well, really, really cool study. Are you going to, so let's talk a little bit about moving on with your career and also, you know, OHBM. Well, the first question that comes to mind from this, though, will you be continuing your studies? So you'll be moving to Jerusalem, actually. Do they have neuroimaging or, I mean, what are you planning on doing? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, I'm going to open my lab in the Hebrew University this summer. They have MRI machine, Prisma machine. So we're definitely going to continue doing some MRI studies of MRI, along with computational and behavioral studies, studying placebo and expectations and beliefs, how they change, and hopefully trying to, you know, to leverage them in clinical practice better. And yeah, so OHBM, it's kind of where I started. Like OHBM was my first international conference, and in Geneva, it was great, and I had so much fun. And ever since, you know, every time I went to OHBM, I really enjoyed meeting with all the friends and colleagues and mentors there. And they're so great. I really feel part of this community. And with NARPS, you know, collaborating with over 180 people from there, it was just amazing for me. And I'm collaborating with many different people, so I'm just having so much fun. I was also in Montreal this summer, and I think it was a great conference. Fortunately, I don't think I would be able to come to Korea this summer because I'm just moving back. But I'm going to miss it this year probably. But still, yeah, I think OHBM will always be the organization I feel like I belong to and I want to go to and I want to send my students to.
I'm glad to hear that. And I do always feel that OHBM is very much fostering of young scientists who also, and it's nice in the sense that they care about the brain, of course, but they care about methods, and they just kind of straddle those two and really help people in terms of figuring out, you know, what the best practices are. And it seems like I do get that sense where the culture is very collaborative. They care a lot about doing things right. And I think you fit in perfectly as far as that's concerned. That's great to hear. Yeah, and it keeps on evolving. I think that, you know, I think at least half the people at OHBM now sort of are doing some sort of a meta-analysis of other databases and things like that. So it's very much becoming even more open science, and, you know, they're evolving the field that way. It just reminds me also, you wrote a piece on virtual conferences, you know, during the height of the pandemic and how to make them more inclusive. And I thought that was really a nice sort of summary of everything. And unfortunately, you know, OHBM is trying to do that, but it's so expensive to do it right. And that's another, everything is sort of comes down to how do you actually lower the costs of these things?
I agree. I think most of the credit for this paper should not go to me. It's the Open Science SIG that I'm a quarter and I help, and it was great. But the Open Science SIG at the time of COVID was in charge of that. I think like it's definitely a challenge because, you know, after a few years of, you know, participating in a few online conferences, even if you really try to make it it's inclusive. I mean, you can be there, but it's just hard to, it's not the same. At the end of the day, the in-person experience is just not the same. So I think that we will have to just have a combination in a way, right? Hopefully people would be able to come to the in-person component, but it would help to record. And OHBM is doing that, right? To record the talks and make them accessible for people who could not come or who came but missed the lecture or were there and want to hear it again. So I think OHBM is navigating that quite nicely. It's not perfect, of course, but I haven't found the perfect solution too. So it's just, I guess we will just continue to make it better, hopefully. And hopefully the prices will go down at the end when technology, you know.
Yeah. I think inevitably it will. And you're right. And I think there's other ways of non-real time, you know, you can always, and I think the community is such that you can always email anyone or contact them and they can give you their data or, you know, there's these databases and code and, you know, it seems like it's becoming more of even if the conference itself is not in real time, virtual, all the information is accessible becoming more accessible thanks to, you know, things like this, what you're doing.
That's important. Yeah. And people are, and yeah, as you said, like the field, I think the neuroimaging field is really one of the, you know, most advanced ones in like open science and sharing, and we're really like making a change. So I really feel fortunate to be part of this, you know, field and belong to this field. So I think we're going through great directions. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of barriers, but
yeah, there's barriers, there's cultural barriers, but and things evolve as they do. But but yeah, you know, the leadership keeps on expanding and growing. And, you know, I think it's a really robust society that also feels like a family. And and you just don't have that, I think, in other types of scientific communities. And I think it really fosters young scientists. A lot of times you have, you know, where the older scientists sort of are there and they sort of dominate with their labs and whatever. And certainly there's, I actually feel that there's much more of this sort of bottom up upswelling of energy at OHBM. So that's great.
Yeah.
And thanks to your work and everything like that, I think that helps foster the whole infrastructure. So
thank you. I'm a small, very, very small part of that, but I'm happy to be a very, very small part of it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think that pretty much covers most everything. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously so much more we could talk about, but yeah, thanks for coming on, and I wish you the very best moving back to Israel, and definitely, hopefully, keeping engaged in OHBM.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was super fun. I'm looking forward to doing it. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Neurosalience is brought to you by Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode is produced by Xichian Michelle Li and Ömer Faruk Gülban.